The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Let's get started. Today we have the workshop. We have a very productive workshop this year. Jenny and I organized it, and it was a good forum to basically start talking, discussing matters of international law and comparative law. So, as you all know, Jenny is an associate professor here, and I don't want to give too much introduction, actually, none, but we all know Rupees was bringing the risking trafficking from his ideological capture, the Pandora Rupees. I just want to say, today on the Wall Street Journal, Jenny's author piece was quoted, and she has this terrific piece called The U.S. Au Pair Program, Labor Exploitation and the Myth of Cultural Exchange, which has been quoted right now in the Wall Street Journal because the au pair lobby is trying to push back against the Congress regulation that wants to regulate the au pair program a bit more along Jamie's line, that this is more of a work program rather than a cultural exchange program. So today we're looking at Jenny's paper that is, you might have seen the draft, the exploitation claim that they are making of human trafficking law. And after Jenny's presentation, 20 minutes, we'll say, then Christian Rogers will give comments. I want to introduce Christian much, just say that.
I know you should introduce him.
But he teaches at Temple Law School. He teaches global labor law and is writing on global labor issues, and so we thought that this was a nice exchange and intersection of topics. And Rishan comes from the organizing and labor background, and among his other classes, employment discrimination, tort law, he's been writing on other issues such as passion and reason in U.S. Sorry. Oh, yeah, and Jenny says the wage test piece is also another other interesting piece if you want to read it. So we're looking forward to this exchange. So Jenny will start, and then Christian will give comments for another 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up. And this is really a way to workshop a working process. So the more feedback, the best, and please feel free to contribute. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Canada. So I'll try to be fast. Less than 20 minutes because I want to hear the comments, especially from Rishan. But I wanted to start with a fix because I've been wanting to get a bunch of you in the same room together for a really long time. This is not your standard academic workshop. You've got a whole section of advocates here who have been working in the trenches on this issue for years, and I really wanted them to be here because this is very much a story about what's happening on the ground, and I want to make sure that that story is accurately portrayed and the implications fully fleshed out. So thank you for coming to this academic exercise. So a little bit of why I wrote this article. It's kind of an inside the Beltway story that I think most people who work in trafficking, certainly internationally, aren't aware of. I think it's a story that a bunch of us have been watching unfold over the last few years, since particularly the entry of the Obama administration. And it's just becoming more and more alarming, and I just wanted to write about it and expose what I think are some moves that really threaten progress, really important progress in the anti-trafficking movement. So I know it's a long article and most of you probably haven't read it, so I'm just going to recap really the main themes of the article and then leave the floor to Rishan. So like I said, this article is a mapping piece. I'm trying to map these moves that have been happening in the field. Some of these moves are doctrinal, some of them are largely rhetorical, but there is a legal reform agenda behind the rhetoric as well, so that's something to be concerned about. So I framed the article Exploitation Creep because it's such, and what I mean by that is this move to label certain practices as more extreme than they are. And part of it is to take advantage of narrative capital, I guess, that comes with these stories. Right? The imagery of slavery is really useful in trying to galvanize momentum behind legal reform, to get people to care about an issue. So I start from the premise that I think a lot of these moves are actually really well-intentioned. So the article really is about mapping these moves and also talking about some of the unintended consequences of these moves. So quick recap. So I identify two creep moves, exploitation creep moves. The first is, and I should say both of these moves are instigated by the U.S. government, particularly the trafficking office, which sits in the State Department. And so I have here, so I tried to map these because there are a lot of pieces. So the State Department, the trafficking office sits in the State Department. The other relevant U.S. government agencies are the Bureau of Democracy, Rights, and Labor, so the Human Rights Bureau of the State Department, DRL, is part of the story, and then also the Labor Department, ILAB, which is the International Labor Affairs Bureau, is also a piece of the story. And then in red, I have the international institutions that are players in the story, which is the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, which is kind of the keeper of the international treaty on trafficking, and then the ILO, which is the sort of keeper of the forced labor convention, forced labor treaty in the international realm. So two creep moves. One is this move to reclassify all forced labor as trafficking. So just to be clear about what these phenomena are. So forced labor is basically a situation where the labor is involuntary and it's undertaken under the menace of penalty. Right? So if you don't engage in this labor, there's some penalty that's going to come at you. And so, you know, forced labor has been the subject of international law for decades. 1930s, part of customary international law, very established norms in the forced labor field. Trafficking is a relatively recent concept, at least the modern version of trafficking. And so I put here the three. It's got this really unwieldy long definition in what's known as the Palermo Protocol, which is the UN trafficking treaty. But the three main elements of the definition are that you have to have some sort of act, which is can be recruitment, movement, transport, transfer, buying, selling of a person, basically, by means of force, fraud, or coercion. That by means of modifies the first element, right? So the recruitment, all of that has to involve some form of force, fraud, or coercion. And then third, that all of this is undertaken for the purpose of exploitation. And they define exploitation with a list of practices. There's some debate about whether or not that list is exhaustive. But they're thinking about situations of forced labor, servitude, slavery, so situations where people feel like they can't leave that labor. And you have to have all three elements in order for it to be trafficking. So this is an important distinction from smuggling, where smuggling stops at the border. There's not the exploitation element of it. And so, essentially, the first creep move is a recharacterization of forced labor, all forced labor, as trafficking, and that's by the trafficking office, which I'll call the TIP office. And just by way of background, the TIP office in the State Department has enormous power in the international realm. Every year, it puts out this trafficking in persons report, and in the report, it ranks what every country is doing on trafficking according to four tiers. But basically, if you fall into the lowest tier, and the tier ranking is based on a country's compliance with a set of U.S. standards on trafficking. Right? And so if you fall into the lowest tier, you may be subject to unilateral sanctions by the U.S. government, economic sanctions. Also, the U.S.'s support for international development from the IMF, World Bank, all of that. So there's a lot at stake in this report and the rankings. So governments tend to respond to the rankings and care about where they rank, especially vis-a-vis other countries. Even if the threat of sanctions isn't that great in terms of the U.S. actually levying sanctions, the reputational risk is something that countries turns out really care about. So this TIP office produces this report, and they have this essentially wield sanctions power. That's why I focused on the actions of the TIP report, because they have had so much influence globally in getting governments to act in ways that are consistent with U.S. norms on trafficking. So essentially, the U.S. is transporting its version of what should be done about trafficking into the international realm, not with notwithstanding the fact that there is an international treaty on trafficking that most, almost 160 countries signed around the world. So a lot of support for the treaty. So anyway, quick number one. So the TIP office has undertaken these moves to say that all forced labor is trafficking. And the ILO actually has traditionally drawn a distinction between forced labor and trafficking. And the distinction really is the sense that you can have a forced labor situation and it only becomes trafficking if there's some form of recruitment or movement that precedes the forced labor, right? So you have to be recruited or moved into the forced labor as opposed to born into it. So when we're dealing with intergenerational bonded labor, like we find in all over the place, but in South Asia particularly, that would be considered non-trafficked forced labor because there was no recruitment in the process. Right? And so the ILO has traditionally distinguished forced labor from trafficking. And like I said, the ILO has been a keeper of these forced labor conventions that have been on the books for decades. So the TIP office comes along and its interpretation of the trafficking definition is to say that, well, all forced labor is trafficking. And, you know, and part of it is that they want to move away from the focus on movement and to say that, you know, what we should really care about is the exploitation on the back end. But what that does is it reduces the three-part definition to basically get rid of the first two elements and you know, focus on the third, which raises the question of legal redundancy and why even have a concept of trafficking if it's just going to be So doctrinally, that's problematic, I think. And then the second move is to also, so during the State Department TIP office is pushing these moves at the same time, right? So all forced labor is trafficking, and then all trafficking is slavery. And with creep number two, the move to slavery, this is more rhetorical, but it started actually at the end of the Bush administration. But then the new current ambassador on trafficking, who heads the TIP office, it's his personal mission to recast everything as slavery. His name's Dabaka. And so Lou Dabaka came into this office, and he wanted to actually change the name of the office to the Office of from the time he came in. So this has been his mission. And so, you know, so some of us have sat down, some people in this room have sat down with him and told him, you know, ran in the Riot Act to say, you know, because slavery has a rarefied status in international law. It's an arm of Hughes Cogan's. It's a super norm in the international sphere. And so to conflate it with other practices problematic doctrinally, and for a number of other reasons that I'll explain. But anyway, so it's the mission of the TIP office under Dabaka to recast everything in slavery. And so it was annoying at first, but then in the fall, this past fall, President Obama and then Secretary Clinton came out with a very public statement saying, this is all, you know, basically saying trafficking is a passe term. It's all slavery. Let's call it what it is. It's all slavery. And part of it is because it's the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and so there's that in the background. But so now everything is being called slavery. And so, you know, it used to be that in these TIP reports, trafficking was used interchangeably with slavery, and in speeches, they would be interchangeable. But now the focus is called slavery. And another piece of this is what's happening on the ground, which is, you know, there's been an anti-slavery movement on the ground as well that's sort of run parallel with the anti-trafficking movement, led by this sociologist, Kevin Bales, you know, who since 1999 has been claiming that there are 27 million people enslaved around the world, right? So you know, he was there making these claims, and for a long time nobody really took that claim seriously, that statistic seriously. But that statistic is now reproduced in the 2012 report. So to just give you a sense of you know, how this phenomenon is portrayed and how it's changed in 2008, these were the statistics that were out there, right? The ILO was reporting that the incidence of forced labor globally was 12.3 million. Only 2.4 million of that was considered trafficking. And then in 2012, it becomes, there are 27 million people enslaved around the world. And then they also use an updated ILO statistic for forced labor of 20.9 million. The TIP report now uses that statistic and says, oh, there's 20.9 million in forced labor. At the same time, they're also saying there's 27 million enslaved around the world. So internally, they're inconsistent. But they're throwing these huge numbers around, which I think has implications for resources and how you allocate them. So basically, you've got these two creep moves, and so now everything's been conflated into slavery. And I mentioned before that this second move is largely rhetorical, but there is a legal reform movement. It's pretty nascent, but it's a group of mostly legal historians and sociologists, including Gayles, who are pursuing an agenda of trying to remake the norm of slavery internationally. So that project is underway and, you know, has the support of the trafficking. As well. So I'm troubled by these moves for a number of reasons. One, doctrinally, it just doesn't mesh with the laws that we have, and I think legal definitions matter. Not just for the sake of legal purists, you know, you don't have to be a legal purist really to care about this. So in terms of implications on the ground, right? So if everything collapses into slavery, what we're seeing and what we've been seeing for a while is that, you know, labor, I should back up a little bit. So these moves have been sort of in the works for a while. So they haven't really come out until very recently, because for the first decade, I'd say, of the anti-trafficking movement, the focus was almost exclusively on sex trafficking. It's only been in the recent years, especially with the entry of the Obama administration, that we've started to shift to look at non-sex sector trafficking. So it's been a really exciting moment in time in the movement because, we have the anti-trafficking advocates and labor rights advocates who never talked to each other in the first decade of the anti-trafficking. Well, with the rare exception of Nang on this
trip. We're not the only one.
Right? I mean, these communities were largely allergic to each other, and it's only in recent years that they started to talk. Part of that is a shift towards starting to view trafficking as a labor issue, a labor migration issue in particular, and that's a really important trajectory, because the way that trafficking laws have been developed, they've taken on, they prioritize criminal laws. It's all about prosecution of the traffickers on the back end. There's virtually nothing done on the front end to try to prevent first place. So this move towards more of a labor paradigm is really important because it starts to get at the structures that create vulnerability to trafficking, right? The fact that labor law tends not to apply to domestic workers and agricultural workers, and that the migration schemes are inadequate to support the flows of migrants, etc. Like all these structural issues that nothing in the trafficking system has even started to address. But now there's conversation because these two advocacy communities are exciting developments, particularly focusing on labor recruitment, which, you know, labor recruiters internationally have not regulated at all. And so there's now a push to try to go after labor recruiters who end up in situations where they're basically putting people in debt, bondage, and servitude. So finally, like, we're at a moment where we're starting to deal with structure. But the argument I make in this article is that this move towards slavery cuts against that movement, because the move towards slavery, I think, is in part to reassert the criminal justice paradigm in this field. I know that's certainly DeBacca's position, right? That this is about crime. It's not about wages. It's not about lower level exploitation. It's a crime, and we need to call it slavery to show how terrible a crime it is, and we need to be aggressive about prosecuting it. Right? And so it's in part a response to the move towards labor that we have this reassertion of the slavery paradigm, or assertion of the slavery paradigm. And I think that's problematic for a number of reasons. So in terms of what's happening to victims of trafficking now, you know, there are very few labor trafficking, the non-sex sector trafficking prosecutions reviewer now, he's the main trafficking prosecutor in DOJ, who was the one who really brought in the labor cases, has been essentially pushed out of DOJ. So now what you find is the only time that they really prosecute labor trafficking cases are when there's clear violence or physical confinement. And the whole point of passing trafficking laws was to recognize that exploitation comes in, and the coercion behind that exploitation comes in a broad range of forms, including psychological coercion, right? Including massive debt that you can never pay off because of the way that the debt is structured. And that was the point of creating trafficking law in the first place, was to recognize a broader set of practices that don't involve violence and don't involve physical confinement. And now we're back to physical confinement and violence in practice. Because I think partly because of this move towards slavery and this pushback and reassertion of the criminal justice paradigm. So that's kind of a snapshot of what I was trying to say in the article. I don't, in terms of questions, I don't know how to end it. I'm not sure where to go. Like I said, it's mostly a mapping. But I do want to flesh out the implications, and so we can talk about the implications on the ground, but I think that there's a bigger idea there that I'm just sort of scratching the surface of, you know, the relevance of the political economy of labor markets on trafficking forms, and those sorts of questions that I need to do more reading on, get more suggestions.
So I have notes, and also I'm here and kind of pace a little bit. We're really happy to be engaged with the piece, and it does overlap with some of my recent work in a number of ways. I want to talk about, actually, one of the questions Jane raised right at the end, how to think about this in the context of global political economy, and also in the context of global justice. And to do that, to shed some light on two questions. First, why exploitation creep, as you've very, very nicely identified, is occurring. And second, why it's really a problem. So a lot of the story here, as I can tell, and I should say I know most of what I know about trafficking from Janie, from her prior articles, the number of conversations we've had, a lot of the story seems to be that anti-trafficking and anti-slavery regulation has exploded in importance over the last 10, 20 years. At the center of the story stands the U.S. in its role as global sheriff, pushing other nations to combat trafficking through a combination of soft and hard law mechanisms. And then surrounding the tip office and the other enforcers are a fascinatingly diverse cast of characters, including various feminist organizations, some Christian conservative groups, a mushrooming number of NGOs, some of them quite well-funded, organizations of excluded workers, and now, late to the party, the official labor movement. So we have here, I think, a really fascinating piece of legal sociology. And raises the question of why these groups converge around this agenda, even though Janie's pointing out some of the fractures within the agenda, there is still a substantial convergence. So one challenge I had of reading the pieces, it was at times tough to understand the different groups' motivations. And so I've tried to unpack that a little bit. Because individuals, you know, can have strong preferences about questions like trafficking and global justice, but they operate within institutions that shape their behavior in myriad ways, of course. And it seems to me part of the story is actually remarkably counterintuitive once you start thinking about it, which is the production of this document. The U.S. has taken a leading role in attacking and seeking to eliminate a major source of global injustice, the elimination of which isn't actually going to satisfy any particular domestic constituency in a financial sense. It may sort of, you know, reinforce their cultural priors in some ways, but there's not money at stake. There's not money funding this in the U.S. For people who will profit off its elimination. And imperial powers don't typically act from altruistic motives. And so this poses a little bit of a puzzle, and part of the answer to it, I think, is found in the paper, pages 17 and 18, then again on 34, and a few other places. Why did we get the Palermo Protocol in the first place? Well, it wasn't clearly out of, it wasn't necessarily out of response to a social movement. It seems like the social movement actors came into the game a little bit later, and wasn't out of altruistic concern for victims, but it seems to have been much more to secure borders and combat organized crime. And it was adopted in 2000, and then came into force in 2003, so it couldn't help but be caught up in the expansion of state capacity to regulate migration and the hardening of citizenship boundaries that has really defined the post-9/11 era. So then it seems to me that also there has to be some additional catalyst to really allow this coalescence of so much NGO activity around the idea of eliminating slavery, and to enable this creep before slavery becoming trafficking, trafficking becoming slavery, and therefore all forms of equating forced labor and slavery more broadly. Institutional prerogatives certainly played a role here, but this is also, I think, a question of legal discourse and ideology. So a suggestion that I'm immediately going to disavow, but that I think is actually nicely prerogative. The French sociologist Loïc Wacan has argued that neoliberalism and the relentless growth of the penal state actually reflect the same underlying social logic. That the only proper role for a neoliberal state, there are two. One is to create the conditions for free markets, and the other is to punish criminals. With criminals increasingly defined as those whose behavior thwarts market rationality. This is a trend. Bernard Harcourt and Ronan Shamir talked about this as well, so has Foucault. Before them, you could write, it seems to me, a whole sociology about dashing men and their grand theories of this sort. But I'm skeptical of Wacan's claims for a number of reasons. It's not at all clear to me that there has to be one underlying social logic of contemporary political economy rather than a great moral pluralism. But I can't help thinking that the paper story of the reemergence of the figure of a slave and a slave trader as persona non grata in contemporary global thought can't be unrelated to neoliberalism. So to come back to the point I made at the beginning, isn't this strikingly ambitious project of global regulation led by the U.S., isn't it striking that this occurs under the two most neoliberal administrations we've actually ever seen? Wacan would argue that this is a strategy through which the state is seeking to maintain its legitimacy after abandoning or failing in the post-war project of actually ensuring fair equality of opportunity via welfare reforms and prudential regulation of industry and finance. And it also makes me think, is this an extension or sort of in the same family as the global war on drugs and the war on terrorism, both of which seem increasingly to be, or have for a long time, seem to be more important symbolically than in terms of their actual effects, if we measure their effects by eliminating the problem they're purporting to target. And then, isn't the figure of the slave and the slave trader reviled in part because they represent the antithesis of liberal regimes of freedom of contract? This isn't to deny the importance of forced labor or quasi-forced labor. It's actually a very important structural element of capitalism in certain parts of the world, including the Gulf states, China, various sectors in the U.S. But rather, to note that condemnation of slavery can actually be fairly easily accommodated within neoliberalism. If we envision the planet as ideally a single market in which goods are moved to their most productive use through the price system, then slavery is a clear interference in that set of market processes, and therefore its elimination could be part and parcel of a neoliberal order. Contrast here two other of the ILO's core labor standards, workers' freedom of association or even anti-discrimination law, both of which sit in some tension with underlying market rationality. So I suspect that this very the otherness of slavery can help explain the massive flow of funding into anti-trafficking, anti-slavery organizations over the past 10 years or so. How am I on time? Good. Okay. So again, I'm skeptical that you can actually assimilate all these phenomena into one overarching social logic, but they do seem to rhyme in a number of ways, and I think it may help to make some sense of the seeming appearance of anti-trafficking out of nowhere and that stability of growth in an era in which most OECD nations are actually retreating from regulatory commitments to social welfare. Now, why is exploitation creep a problem? And getting a little bit, Janie, to your question of what to do, here I'm not, I talk about why I think it's a problem, but I don't have great suggestions on what to do. It seems to be a problem because it, as you say, prevents the emergence of a more robust labor-focused and structural approach to the problem of trafficking. And I think that human rights types and labor types can actually converge around this. That doesn't seem so problematic to me. If we just think there are various structural injustices in the global economy and the global sort of the global basic structure that cause a lot, so many in the world to live in dismal poverty, those can't be defended under any serious theory of global justice or global ethics. But they can sort of, I think this, the, part of the distinctive contribution of a labor paradigm, at least in some veins, would be to cast a wider net on the scope of which structural injustices really matter. So it's not just access to jobs, it's not unequal access to the workforce, it's not poverty per se, it's also trade regimes, it's financialization, and probably most importantly, it's citizenship regimes. So the problem is that if the trafficking system is really largely built around the idea of protecting borders and security, then a facial attack on citizenship regimes seems really pretty clearly off the table here. Any consensus between human rights types, labor types, and national security experts, national security types around that question is going to fall apart when you come to questions of citizenship. The other thing a labor perspective might bring to the table is to say what we need are domestic and transnational workers' organizations democratically structured that can actually challenge the political and economic power of industry and finance in setting the global terms of cooperation. But it seems to me quite clear that finance types who are very happy to combat slavery are not going to sign on to that program because it would create more seriously alter the balance of power. So, in conclusion, I guess the question I have is does it make sense to think of this in the same breath as the war on drugs and the war on terror, as a regulatory regime led from the center that's constantly growing in political and economic importance, targeting various global others, but ultimately perpetuating the very same injustices that it purports to attack? And if so, then exploitation creep seems like a very significant part of the problem, as Jane points out, that it can crowd out other more structural solutions. But I guess I'm hesitant to think that the trafficking regime can really be the place where these battles are fought because of the difficulty of getting consensus around which structural conditions really matter. And as a final thought, maybe it shouldn't be the place we fight this out, because this story of how so many different groups with such different agendas have been assimilated over time into this one this discourse of criminalization, slavery, and national security, I think has frightening implications for questions of how imperial power can actually be resisted today. So, thanks again, and I look forward to the discussion.
Let's take questions. I don't know if you want to take several at a time or just see what's going on.
I don't know. If people have comments, questions on the draft or anything that was said, I can respond.
No.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. This is really interesting. Thank you so much. I guess I had a few thoughts, some of which are in line with Brishan's. One is, I wonder if you can situate it a little bit more in sort of a broader theoretical frame in terms of thinking about what you want to do with it. And I really loved what you said about narrative capital. And I wonder if you can use that to frame the piece a little bit. So you pointed towards, I think, some ways that Creep 1 and Creep 2 are the same and some ways that they're different. And I wonder if you could drill down more on that in terms of the different work that these labels are doing in the different cases. Because I'm not sure if they're doing the same thing. I think in the Creep number 1, and this is in line with Brishan's comments, part of what's going on with some of these transitions is that we had this huge problem of what is coercion? And we want to differentiate coercion from the typical conditions of the labor market that we expect. So it kind of goes to like the Hale stuff of just like all labor is coercive. And so I think the first move is about how the framing it in terms of trafficking and sex work makes us much less concerned about the consent problem, because we think like, okay, people are less likely to consent to that. But I don't know if the second move is that or not, is about this consent, the same thing about getting away from the coercion problem. In one way, I think it might be in terms of sort of Brishan's comments that it otherizes this from our standard labor practices, that this is trafficking, this is slavery, this isn't just labor where it's harder to see where the coercion is. So I might think about that, the differences or similarities. And then I also wondered whether this could be thought of as sort of a public choice problem, and that it's going on a one-way ratchet in terms of the creep. Because once this is framed as in the criminal sort of regime, I wondered about theories of punishment. So, I mean, you can think about it in terms of the sort of retributist, and that seems what you're focused on, more of the sort of expressive value versus the deterrence value of these different, thinking about these as forced labor versus trafficking versus slavery. And I wondered, I mean, are there different punishments, I guess? Like, what are the different material consequences for being prosecuted in these different ways? And there's some basic objection to this of marginal deterrence problems if these, depending on whether these punishments are different. And you make a suggestion briefly about whether trafficking is worse than labor. And you seem sort of focused on the legal distinction between these things. But I wondered, are they worse? Is trafficking worse? And if it is, then it should be treated differently. If not, then maybe it shouldn't be. So
I'm keeping the cue. Oh no, sorry, ma'am, I didn't mean to.
So, and where are the sort of accused in the story? And they don't seem to have any representatives, and that's sort of the public choice story here that everybody's kind of focusing on the victims.
People say who they are, just for them to come out. People, it's really kind of, we were just saying it's helpful to know who works directly on trafficking.
Who doesn't, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, thank you. Naomi Shonram at GW Law School.
So I have five people. Do you want to take a
minute? Sure.
And so I have Jamie.
Thank you, Fernanda. I'm Jamie Raskin. I'm Jamie's colleague here at WCL. So you got a lot going on in your piece, and it's great. I mean, it's chock full of ideas. Here's some ideas I had about ways of improving kind of each section of it. One is to have a more formal separation of your analysis of the doctrine first, and then an analysis of the rhetoric, because they kind of get interwoven in ways that don't allow us to see when this conflation you're talking about actually makes a difference on the ground in terms of cases that are being brought or prosecution. So it would be helpful to have sort of a lawyer's part on how these translations are confusing things in terms, then move to the rhetorical part, you know, and then I think you need a section. And this goes to the last comment, I think, that gets to politics and theory, which I think is very interesting to me. Now, you know, I think that you need to beef up your analysis of slavery in American constitutional, political, and historical discourse, because, you know, there was a central dilemma and controversy over this going all the way back to, you know, pre-Civil War, where John C. Calhoun was taking on, you know, Wendell Phillips and Thaddeus Stevens and saying, you guys are all upset about the slaves down here. You've got wage slaves in the North. And while we're invested for a lifetime in the bodies that are our property, you throw these people away in the North, and so slavery in the South is a much more civilized system than wage slavery in the North. And so, like, that ambiguity and controversy has been there from the beginning, you know, and I don't know if you've read Douglas Blackman's new book, Slavery by Another Name, where he talks about basically the reinstitution of slavery-type systems after the Civil War, after Reconstruction ended, through the imposition of the Black Codes and the criminalization of the Black population so that people could be convicted of anything minor and then suddenly sold back to the people who used to be their slave masters or rented back. So I think that, and that gets to, I think, what's most interesting about it to me, which is the theoretical ambiguities about what is slavery, what is consent, and Grecian's point in, you know, contemporary world commerce, what is labor, what's free labor, what's not, what's unfree labor, and how do we define consent in this context? And so the discussion of slavery, I think, itself is ambiguous because it can move in either direction. It could either say we've got to look at the oppressive dynamics and ingredients that exist in a whole range of practices where people are being brought from the Philippines to Iraq to staff the bars and the hotels and the fast food, right? Look at the question of exploitation today. You know, what does exploitation mean? So, and the final thing just is a constitutional point, and I've actually written some stuff about this which I can share with you, but, you know, the 13th Amendment distinguishes between slavery and involuntary servitude. So, you know, even in the terms of the 13th Amendment, there is a distinction, you know, which roughly parallels, I think, the distinction you're talking about between slavery and forced labor or peonage. So I think that you need to engage a little bit more the constitutional discourse on this, because obviously there is an American frame to the whole thing. It's pretty much the same.
Thank you, Jamie. That was Jamie Raskin from Washington College of Law, also Maryland Senator. Now, John Ackerman.
Hi, I'm John Ackerman. I'm visiting here at AU, but I'm normally at Mexico City at the Institute for Legal Research there. There are a lot of things that emphasize something very specific. That book, what is it called? This study, transporting. What's the name of that?
State of
Trafficking.
Okay.
How long has that existed for?
2001.
4 years?
No, since 2001.
It comes out every
2001.
It's congressionally mandated.
It seems to me.
They have to ban it.
It seems to me that you could do a very simple exercise that would help you empirically in terms of just looking at the last 13 years of that book and see how countries have changed in their rankings and how what that corresponds to in terms of how these are actually, I mean, is it actually the countries have done something, or is it that this slippage is actually happening in terms of practical consequences? This is something we see all the time in international anti-corruption indicators. Countries move all the time, not because it's actually done anything, but because the indicators have changed. And so if there actually is a slippage that has practical impact, you should be able to see that. That would be just one suggestion. And the second thing would be just a thought experiment. If the United States were actually a benevolent empire, which I completely agree with Jamie in the evaluation of what's going on here, structure at least. But if it were I think that how would you rank the countries? I mean, does this ranking actually make any sense?
No.
At all? Okay.
I mean,
so if you had a more labor-based one, what would the ranking look like? And I think that could be a powerful, just sort of symbolic, you know, this is how they should be ranked. I mean, you know, you don't have to actually do the empirical work, but just in general, like, what would actually change on the ground if they were to implement your standards and not the ones that they are doing? And there I think we would see that perhaps there is a difference between the international regime around trafficking of persons and anti-terrorism and the drug war, which is an important comparison which is bringing up, because in the end, drugs are not bad, right? The war against drugs is ridiculous, right? Regardless of how we enforce it. Here we are actually talking about a problem, okay, which is either slavery or trafficking, or, you know. And so there is potential there in the way that there is not potential in the drug war metaphor. You know, terrorism is even more complicated, probably somewhere in the middle. But I think there is a real potential there. That's why it's so important, your analysis here. But it would help to play it out this in that more specific way.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alvaro Santos from Georgetown University Law Center. So I really like your paper, and what I want to do is just play the skeptic for a little bit. I wasn't convinced by the two main punchlines that I see in the argument of why creeping is a bad idea. It seems to me that the first part of the paper does a lot of work basically showing the vagueness of the standards and then the ways in which the different groups have advocated for collapsing them, and so which you explain really well. But I kept thinking, well, why should we care about this? Why would this be negative? It seems like on your own account, it's actually provided for a lot of mobilization, for a lot of fundraising. People are talking about it. Labor is in. It seems like it actually has had a lot of really powerful developments that can lead to action that otherwise wasn't happening. And so I kept thinking, okay, so yes, I understand the tensions, I understand the competition between the ILO and the US, you know, agencies, but why is this bad? And you provide two arguments that I think you could sort of actually start the article with. So start with this question of why should anyone care about this other than the legal purist, which you actually raise very nicely, but it's kind of halfway in the paper. So I would foreground that question and then state what your claims are about why this is negative. And the two claims you give are, one is that it lowers it increases the threshold for trafficking because it equates it with slavery, and at the same time it dilutes the threshold of slavery. And so there, what I would invite you to do is to provide more examples of how this works out, right? Either in court cases or how you think some groups that would be benefiting from trafficking wouldn't now that it's raised to the status of slavery, and the opposite, right? Because it seemed to me that it wasn't necessarily clear why that would be bad, that, you know, if you have now a much bigger pool and people can qualify as being subjected to slavery and the slavery test has been lowered or diluted, then you have a bigger net. And actually, that might be a good thing for people who are under these conditions who before really didn't make it in. And so that's the first negative consequence that I think was really clear and powerful, but probably need a little bit more development. And the second one, which I also thought was really ingenious and strong, was that focusing on slavery intensifies the attention to individual perpetrators if it's treated as a criminal problem, right? Rather than focusing on the structural problems, which I think is a very important point. But there I was thinking that maybe slavery can also have the opposite effect, that slavery is historically a structural problem, and it's been dealt with and analyzed as an economic problem, an economic phenomenon, where countries were using slaves for economic purposes. And so it wasn't really, it doesn't need to have that turn of focusing on individual criminal activity and perpetrators or victims, but it could also be understood as this is a condition of our global economy, that slavery is back again. And so I think it would be helpful to sort of see why slavery has the role that you think it might have, I would say. And so there, you might be right, but it would be helpful just to address this other possibility. And so this brings me to one of Richard's comments, which was that maybe slavery, and one of the ways to understand why the U.S. is now putting so much effort or attention to slavery, is a way to legitimate all other types of labor that we might even thought of or think of as, you know, problematic or undesirable, but you really draw a bright line where this type of labor is unacceptable and the bar is really minimum. It's under certain coercive conditions that, you know, you can't accept, and they're all the rest of the labor in the global economy is accepted. And so slavery might be playing that role, perhaps, and so you would be wanting to push against it in the paper. And then finally, the last comment is, at some point you go back to why would it be good to use the labor paradigm to deal with this problem, which I thought it was a really nice discussion. But I was a little... confused by the way you use, I guess another way to put it is I saw that there was like a disconnect between that discussion and the previous part of the paper, partly because you're engaging there with people who have advocated the labor paradigm to deal with sort of trafficking, like Hila Shamir and others. And there what happened is that you're sort of responding to them by showing how labor has in fact come into the fold in the trafficking agenda, and human rights has done, you know, relatively good work in your analysis of bringing this question in a more nuanced way than previously. But it seemed to me that this sort of conciliation, where labor has also come to join hands with the trafficking advocates, was precisely something that you have criticized in the first part of your paper as problematic, or something that should give us pause. And so I guess it would be helpful to clarify how you see that bringing the labor paradigm could do this work that you think it would.
Ninka? Hi, I'm Ninka Grossman. I'm at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Thank you, Janie. Very interesting. I learned a lot. I have a couple of smaller points. I didn't have a chance to read your paper, so what I'm saying comes from the conversation today. One thing that keeps coming to mind, just from sort of the transnational crime side, is the significance of taking out the jurisdictional element, right? So the fact that trafficking, I think, usually includes an element where you have to cross a jurisdictional boundary, or is that not... You don't have to. Okay, so that's interesting that is not part of it anymore. But I guess one way I was thinking about this was the frames that CREEP 1 and CREEP 2, sort of how they move, how they progress. So forced labor law, right? Trafficking, you can see as sort of international criminal law. And then you've got trafficking to slavery, international criminal law, to something closer to human rights law, even, you could argue. And so I'm wondering if, I mean, first, it seems like this is a political strategy, right, to just name it slavery because it's more compelling to people to get behind it when it's slavery than when it's forced labor or trafficking. And sort of wondering what Alvaro was saying about why that matters, that we're reframing it in different ways. And also, from a domestic political standpoint, I think it's sort of interesting that, you know, a democratic administration that has a lot of its support from the labor movement is reframing this issue from a more labor-oriented image to a more sort of international criminal law, human rights kind of approach. So what does that say even about the way that we think about labor rights in the United States? What are the implications we can draw about domestic politics in the U.S. from this shift? That was something, and I think that relates to Jamie's point about doctrine versus rhetoric, and, you know, using the language of slavery, it seems to me like a political tool. So again, I agree very much with that point. Why does that matter from a doctrinal standpoint?
I have Inke, and first Ezra, and then Maya.
Great. So I think I had a similar response as Alvaro at first, which is, why do we care about somebody going after what's hot? We all do this. You know, just look at what people write about. They write about what's hot. The same is true with the bureaucracy. You could tell a less theoretical story and a more just bureaucratic story, which is, here is a bureaucrat that figures out what's hot and is using what's hot in order to get more resources. And they just to put it in WCL terms, we know the type. I think that that is not, doesn't require this whole idea about what the U.S. is, but more about the players and what they are. But then I was thinking, what is the problem? And I think the problem might be that it's just descriptively inaccurate. And so I was thinking about it. When you teach legal writing, you often get rid of the varies. You tell students to cross out very whenever something, you know, they want to put very all the time, you cross out the very. And so I was thinking, Alvaro has a very good beard. If I say that, some of you will disagree with me. If I just said he has a good beard, you might agree with me. And I think that's the problem here, is that we're exaggerating the problem, we are, or at least people are, risking it not reflecting reality, both for what we as Americans looking at the experience understand it to be, but perhaps more importantly, what the people in the experience in the other countries think of that. So if they see labor that they're mostly used to, they might not agree with all this negative connotations to it. So in the U.S., you know, in classes here, you bring up the idea of a live-in nanny or maid, and people get up. Students often will have a violent reaction to it, and then you do it in another country, and it's like, of course. So I think that there is a danger there, and it's not very legal, but there's a danger in this non-accuracy in the end by overselling it, undercutting much of what the progress it has been made. So that's what I want.
Fanea?
Okay, so I'm Fanea Mishra. I'm an international worker rights activist from an organization called the Solidarity Center. With full disclosure, we are an allied organization of the AFL-CIO, so I'm coming to this from a labor perspective and a practitioner's perspective. And I have to say, everyone who just spoke before me was an academic. And for those of us who are non-academics and to be in this setting, sometimes it's really intimidating because you guys, you know, can cite things from, you know, 1920 and articles that such and such wrote, which I have them, all those articles that you're citing stacked on my desk that I wish to read. I have not had time to read them, including Janie's paper. I've only read half of it, but I did promise her to read the whole thing. And I do have specific comments that I'll give you to you later, but just, I'm one of those people, and Janie and I love Janie, and she knows this, and she and I have been working together on this issue for a really long time, but I'm one of those people who has pushed to make things murky. I'm one of those people who has pushed really hard to get the U.S. tip office to make things blurry and not to stick to international legal definitions of what is forced labor, what is trafficking, etc. Because as a labor rights activist, I worked in our office in Jakarta, Indonesia for 5 years, and I kept saying there are migrant workers, millions of migrant workers, migrating under a development plan of the Indonesian government. They have no plan to create jobs where people live. They have a plan to send people abroad. And those people are being exploited in severe forms of exploitation, and nobody cared. Nobody gave a shit, excuse my language. And then the Palermo Protocol was passed, the TBPA was passed in 2000, and surprise, surprise, in 2001, we got a $2.5 million grant from USAID to counter trafficking, and what that grant was to deal with migrant worker exploitation. That's what we made it. We called it trafficking. I spun it really well. The language is really pretty. But it was a program to address exploitation of migrant workers that we weren't able to do before. And so with that said, I too would like to hear a little bit more about where did that get us and where are we going now? Because I am a little bit afraid of what you said at the end there, that now, you know, we were bringing up labor rights and we're doing all this, and now they're talking about slavery and they're moving this, and the person in the Department of Justice is gone and they're not prosecuting this, like the Global Horizons case. Why did that prosecution end? That's a really good question. And so I am concerned, because we've done such a good job now of getting people to see the labor exploitation piece of this, that they are pushing back, and what does that mean? And so we do need to go somewhere else, but I'm not necessarily sure that Creep 1 was such a bad thing. I have a problem with Creep 2, but I don't have a big problem with Creep 1. And I actually think it's pushed the ILO. One of the issues that the problem with the ILO was the Forced Labor Convention was passed in 1929. Debt bondage in the form that it's practiced today, I realize it's always been around, but in the form that it's practiced today, 1929 wasn't being considered as a form of forced labor. It is now considered a form of forced labor, and the ILO is responding to that. I'm not sure we would have gotten the ILO to do that if it wasn't for all this that happened. And a lot of amazing things are happening. The fact that, as you mentioned in the paper, that the Senate immigration reform bill that just came out of committee that's going to be debated on the floor has labor recruiter regulations in it under a subtitle that says trafficking in persons. That would not have happened unless this happened. And so I'm kind of like, I'd like to just hear a little bit more in your paper about the consequences of that and where do we go next. And I have to also say, I think that there needs to be a little bit more nuance because in the U.S., everything that you said about where we got places is true, but overseas, you know, as I said, in 2001, we were doing a labor trafficking project in 2001, and we weren't the only ones. And I think there also is a little bit more credit to the TIP report and a little bit more nuance there because I think if you compare the 2001 TIP report to 2013, one, the size has gone up tremendously, but their discussion and the nuance of the discussion of labor trafficking is huge. They talk, you know, in 2001 it was all sexual exploitation. In 2013 they talk about contract workers and they talk about the particular vulnerability of migrant workers and labor recruiters. I mean, the discussion in there is very good. When it comes to ranking countries, we know it's all bullshit, and that doesn't. And I'm sorry, academics wouldn't say bullshit, would you? But it, you know, the rankings are all bullshit, but that's political. But the narrative is good. And it was really, you know, I have to say, we weren't the only ones. I'd love to have Solidarity Center take the only credit, but from 2001, Solidarity Center and others were sitting in front of JTIP in meetings and saying labor trafficking, labor trafficking, labor trafficking, and Mark Taylor and others listened. And it wasn't, and it didn't just start with Ambassador Sidibaka. John Miller, forget him, he was useless on this, but Ambassador Lagon did hear it. And that's when we started getting more and more attention to labor. And I also think that they started to see what really modern day forms of exploitation, what are they? Because they were looking at the migrant workers who were leaving from Indonesia and other places, and they were hearing all these cases, and they were looking at the Gulf, and they said, we can't talk about just sexual exploitation in the Gulf, right? Qatar, United Arab Emirates. And they saw, oh my gosh, this is about labor migration, and this is about, and there's a lot more nuance there. And so I'm a little bit, I told Jamie, her paper gave me a little bit, I was scared, because it's all true, and I agree with it. It's not that I disagree with you, but some of the conclusions of what does it mean and where do we go. And the slavery thing scares me more, because then I think we're moving away. When you say forced labor, then I get labor people's attention, and I think that's really helpful.
Awesome. Thank you. I have Amanda, Susan, Elise, and more people.
So I'm Amanda. I teach at ADU also, and I don't work in this area, so this is just my reactions coming to it cold. I agree that you need to tease apart a little more sort of what are the potential pros and the potential cons of these shifts. And in particular, it seems to me they fall into two general categories. One is that somehow by changing the terminology, you're raising or lowering the bar. And the other is that you're changing what the responses are likely to be, as you said, shifting, you know, from a labor response to a more of a punitive sort of response. Focusing on the first one, whether you're raising or lowering the bar, it's really interesting to me just looking at your two equations there, that as you shift from all forced labor, calling all forced labor trafficking, it seems to me that potentially is quite expansive in terms of increasing the category of things that you would consider because it removes the sort of movement of the labor.
Right, obviously.
And changes the focus so that you're not looking just at who is coercing the labor, but also who is creating the condition that makes it likely that the labor would move into the coercive situation. So you're focusing at where folks are coming from and also where they're going to. So you're sort of expanding the range of parties that might be complicit, expanding the range of possible punitive approaches, expanding the range of regulation that would be necessary. You need to fix the home situation and also the destination situation, etc. And then the creep two is exactly the opposite, right? Creep two is a restrictive move, it seems to me. Because slavery has at least colloquially a definition that's set in everybody's mind, and that feels much more restrictive, and now suddenly you're raising the bar. I mean, I understand you're also
diluting the meaning of slavery, but
it seems to me principally that Creep 2 is a way of raising the bar for what counts, because there are a lot of uncomfortable labor situations that we wouldn't think of as being slavery. And so I'd like you to see you engage a little more with why one entity would want to make both moves, right? One move, they seem to be in very differing directions. And then related to that, and this is a much narrower question, but it seems to me, given that you're principally arguing, at least on the bar side of the equation, not on the solutions side of the equation, but you're principally arguing that what's being done here is to raise the bar, I don't understand how the numbers have close to doubled. So I wanted some engagement with that, right? Why, when we raise the bar, do we suddenly go from whatever that is, 14.7 million included, to 27 million? If the problem is that the bar has been raised, you'd think the numbers would go down. So.
Susan.
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 I also teach at WCL. So this is wonderful, and I've heard it being taught in a class, and read part of the paper, and heard and talked to Janie about this before. And it seems to me, I completely buy your and Brisson's analysis of sort of what's going on here and the reasons why this phenomenon is happening at the level of political rhetoric and the dangers of it. I completely understand that. But I do think there's something about, and this is going to echo what some other people said, but maybe with a little bit of a different twist. I mean, all politics is rhetoric, right? And it's all about analogies and narratives and images and metaphors and tropes. And so it's going to be like that. Yeah. That's sort of the way people talk. And what matters is getting a good strategic hold on the rhetoric that you're using and understanding both the benefits and drawbacks. So this wonderful, I forgot your name now, but getting the injection of reality from an activist was the best contribution to this whole discussion, to see how sometimes using the rhetoric actually is beneficial. You know, so we can see that sometimes it's going to be beneficial, sometimes it's not. And even though I know, Janie, because I've talked to you before, you don't like spending too much time on the U.S. historical example of the U.S. institution of slavery, because, you know, that's, we can go too far in doing that kind of analogizing. But, you know, certainly the metaphor slavery was used a lot to talk about a lot of things that were vestiges of U.S. slavery and institutions like debt bondage and blackman's work and all of that. And sometimes, you know, it was a good idea to do that for more limited purposes. But it seems to me that you, and also you, especially as read through Brisson, you really are concerned about the injustice of the structures of labor, you know, the way that labor is set up to exploit vulnerable people around the world. And the thing is, we don't have a set of rhetorical tools that really gets people upset about that, because in a way, that's sort of what you would expect. Right, I mean, you know, and it, so what, I guess I'm left wondering, what are the rhetorical moves? Do you see that sometimes, I understand at the level of analysis, and you're such a good lawyer, and you're really insistent on, let's do this analytically right, and when you do it right, I'm completely convinced that you're completely right about all of your steps here and what's going on, and that's true at the level of analysis, but there's this other level of discourse that's just about what buttons are we going to push, what narratives are we going to tell, how are these going to work, and how will they work better? And, you know, I'm not sure that you're totally finished the story about when these narratives actually could be useful and when they're not, and what these substitute narratives are.
I have four more people.
I thank you so much for all of these comments. I actually am ambivalent about point number one, because I do see, I mean, as Neha said, I actually, when I first started writing this, I actually was pro Creep 1 and anti Creep 2. But doctrinally, Creep 1 is wrong, and I had to grapple with that. And maybe what I say is, okay, that's okay, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I do think that there is a problem with Creep 1 in terms of resource allocation, right? I mean, the numbers do go up dramatically as you expand out. So that means, I mean, institutionally, it means a contest of resources between iLab and tip off is, because like Ezra was saying, this is a bureaucratic turf battle. Right. At some level, there's definitely a turf battle. The turf battle that had to be resolved by the NSC, it got so nasty. So I mean, I do think that there are negative consequences of that move, but overall, I see a lot of benefits, exactly as Neha said, about expanding. So part of me is tempted to end with the last section saying, I mean, considering, like, we're not going to move away from this, right? We're stuck with the groups, I think. I don't think there's any sort of taking back the group. So, I mean, maybe this gets to Alvaro's point about, well, maybe there's a different story to tell about slavery historically. Like, maybe there's a way that we can advocate and push for a different telling of slavery. Right? It's not just about crime, it's about economic structures. And so part of me was tempted to sort of end with this sort of advocacy, you know, oriented. Or, you know, just thinking about, well, going forward, we accept that this has happened, how do we make the best of it, right? And maybe there's a way to embrace the slavery analogy that's more nuanced to transit structures. I don't think that's going to happen, but, I mean, I think maybe it's a worthy agenda to pursue.
So I have Liz, Martina, Heather, and Janet.
I'll be brief. Liz Keyes with the University of Baltimore, but speaking more with my former practitioner hat on. There's a couple of other places that I think maybe deserve to be on the map that end up helping, although I think they initially complicate the story a little bit. Places where trafficking gets analyzed, I think, a little bit more faithfully to the definition. I'm thinking mundanely of immigration, where in this minute office in Vermont, they are steadily extending benefits to people who qualify under the definition, regardless of sort of the level of assault or whether there's been sexual violence or whatever. They look at the definition, they apply it, and so that's been a really expansive broadening of protection to
the
Vermont Service Center. And so the expansiveness has been really helpful to individuals there. Likewise, with civil trafficking, people have been pretty fearless about putting forward some wonderful, I look at Anita, labor trafficking cases that really are faithful to some of the structural problems that trouble us as advocates. I think where that comes, so I think those are worthy of inclusion as you map things out. Where I think it comes back to strengthening your case about the unintended consequences is that advocates themselves, with some rare exceptions, buy into the creep too and stop identifying people coming toward them who might qualify under the definition as slaves, because we think of slavery, it has a very specific, narrow narrative meaning. And so it's even though we have the tools and there are places in the system where people could get the benefits and access to justice that the laws provide, advocates themselves are buying into the narrative and potentially becoming a gateway against them accessing all of those things. So I think it supports your thesis in the end, but I think it
needs to be complicated before it.
Yeah, that's great.
So I have, my name is Martina Vandenbroek. I'm a civil litigator and I handle trafficking cases pro bono. So I have three words, Janie. One is sex, one is power, and one is juries. The remarkable thing about this board is that the word sex and sex trafficking is not on this board. And I will argue that that is nothing short of a revolution. You could not have a conversation about trafficking 10 years ago without having the entire dominant narrative be a fight. I called it the prostitution wars. We had it in Palermo at the Vienna negotiations. I mean, the prostitution wars dominated the trafficking world to such a great degree that people fled like refugees. And so to not take that sort of prostitution war context into account, I think is to not give sufficient credit to what has happened here, which I fundamentally disagree with, but I think is a brilliant, brilliant pirouette of changing the debate. And maybe I'm giving Ambassador Lucy DeBacca too much credit, but I think, Janie, I would challenge your fundamental thesis, because I think that this is a different project altogether.
mean, I think Neha and Solidarity Center had an enormous impact on where this went, but there was also a beautiful confluence of interests here, because you have to remember that 10 years ago, the IG was doing inspections of people's files at USAID to see whether they were using the terms sex work. Ambassador Miller was denouncing people and creating what I argue at the time were blacklists of people who dared to utter the term sex work. It was such a rotten time, frankly, to be in this world that many people fled. So the idea that what Lou has done is transcend the debate. And I would argue that that was one of his main motives, was this transcendence. Because if you make that huge leap from sex all the time, all about prostitution, and all prostitution is trafficking, because that's the creep that has crept back, right? That's the uncreep. Because no one will say, within their right mind anyway, that all prostitution is trafficking, which was the fundamental narrative in the 90s. So if you look at it in that context, this is a bureaucratic act of pure genius. Because what he has done, I'm, you know, being devil's advocate here, what he has done is he has stolen the language that they stole from us. He stole the language of abolition. Now, to be a new abolitionist is to be someone who is against forced labor, not someone who is an advocate of abolishing prostitution, which is what the Coalition to Abolish Trafficking in Women, CATW, was all about. And so this is an amazing, poetic act of valor. part of this is hyperbolic argument. Starting with sex, I really think, Janie, that this reconceptualization of the entire debate, I think because we all are so steeped in that world, we fail to see it, but it is a different world. The work I do now is so different than the battles I fought 10 years ago, and I got to say, it's no longer exhausting. I think all of us who are on the right side of this see tremendous movement forward rather than, you know, horrible fist fights in meetings. And, you know, things like the University of Pennsylvania, which was a gruesome meeting. All right, so the second is power. And, you know, you touch on this in the article, and I'll give you comments specifically in the article, but a lot of this is power, but also a question of efficacy. So ILO, iLab, is all about carrots. The tip office is all about sticks. There are many people in the anti-trafficking and anti-forced labor world who believe quite strongly that carrots don't work and sticks do. And so this was an attempt by the State Department to bring into its orbit all forced labor so that the sticks could be used to wound offenders so that it wasn't just all about carrots.
Right.
The third is juries. My great fear in the creep tube world is juries, and this is already happening. And I've talked to Kevin Bales about this. I beg him not to use this language in expert reports that he authors. I like slap out of them every reference to slavery. The problem is, if a jury is thinking about slavery, they want to see whips, they want to see chains, they want to see someone roped to a heater. They want to see Cincinnati, right? They want to see people locked inside, raped and tortured. And I got to tell you, that's not what we have. And I'll just give you one really sort of bitter example. This was not the case, but recently there was a trafficking case involving forced labor, and the defense attorneys got up at the end of the case and said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this is not slavery. That is the nuclear option. This is something far less." And they won, right? They won on that point. So we are fighting a battle that has bigger implications in terms of public understanding of what's happening. I think you're absolutely right, Liz. It's also harder to sell pro bono cases where there's not extreme levels of physical violence. The last point, again, going to this question of power and juries, it's the intersection of those two points. The State Department is moving towards forced labor. I would argue that part of the reason that they have taken these creep one and creep two moves is because you still cannot talk about sex work in the context of labor, right? So they're walking a very thin line in order to be able to talk about forced labor without sort of
laborizing sex work without blessing that concept because they sort of can't. But as you see the State Department running towards forced labor, you see the Department of Justice running in exactly the opposite direction because is still seeped in sex trafficking prosecutions, though I think they would personally deny it. And what is worse is now as we have state laws, many of them totally misguided on the books in all 50 states, those states are only dealing with sex. So, you know, you have all of these countervailing tendencies, all of these very, very tense situations, but we cannot in this discussion lose sight of sex and what sex meant to the anti-trafficking movement for such a long time.
Yeah. Very much. First, my keynote word, Heather, and then Jen.
I'm Heather Hughes. I teach here at WCL. I just have a comment to the draft as a paper. This is not my area. So in the introduction, you reference a taxonomy of areas of law that are relevant. You know, you reference criminal law, labor law, immigration, and constitutional law via the slavery component. And in the way you present it, what fortifies the taxonomy is resource allocation, differing institutional capacities and different perspectives of people in the various fields. And then we have this issue, trafficking, which for which the taxonomy is not helpful. It could go here, it could go there, it's creeping, where do we want it, which sort of frames the whole paper. So then when you get into the meat of your paper, you're doing two different things, it seems, that are in tension, and they don't have to be in tension, but it feels like they are in this draft. On the one hand, you're advocating that trafficking be a labor issue because you like the consequences of that. There's a consequentialist aspect, you know, to the voice in the paper. And yet at the same time, you're doing an analytical project and saying that it belongs there, that it's a legal concept, and that if we analyze the four corners of it as a legal concept, we see it as a labor issue. So my question for you then is, does anything other than resource allocation and institutional capacity make the taxonomy of fields of law functional? Because if not, you're trying to do two, right? The legal concept and the analysis of the legal concept. But it's difficult to convince a reader that you're doing more than one. You know, wanting to call it one thing rather than another because of a consequentialist political objective.
Right. Last but Jen.
Hi, Jen Muller. I also teach here, and not in this field whatsoever, but having sat through this fantastic discussion and read the paper, I feel like I know everything I need to know in order to comment. And this really pulls out two sort of, I think, maybe not throwaway ideas, but one of them I think was actually just in parentheticals in the paper. I'm actually convinced, because I believe that words should have meaning, and I also agree with going at the structural underlying issues to all of this, that I agree with your argument. And yet, as I think about slavery, and I think about why slavery has such a historical, what it really is about, and you mentioned this in here, it's because in a lot of these other situations, once you're free, if somebody escapes a la Cincinnati, they're free, whereas with slavery, there was a state or a government sanction or government, there was another layer that that complicated things. And it makes me wonder, because one of the other issues you raise here is that trafficked persons, when they are found here, have a number of additional hurdles to go through in the immigration context before they actually can be essentially freed or before they can live here. It made me wonder whether one of the advantages to seeing this all as slavery was to identify the way the systematic impediments to freeing people once they are found and identified and released and sort of using that rhetoric back against the government.
Immigration.
I don't know this field, so I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that's a really great insight. I want to make a plug for this book. So this is Denise Brennan. We've been very quiet, but she's
an expert. This is the last point.
Oh, good. Exactly. So she wrote this great... This is a manuscript of her book that's about to come out on life after trafficking, and it gets
to this point of, you know, what happens after you're trafficked, there's actually still low-wage workers, you know, working in horrible conditions, just that they're no longer trafficked. So, I mean, going back to this point of, you know, the slavery narrative and the way the picture is a more nuanced one that's relevant to the situation, is it, I mean, the situation, I mean, coming out of forced labor, you're still in crappy, crappy working conditions, right? And not like suddenly they identified as trafficking and everything's great.
Nobody gave you 40 acres of mule. You don't have 40 acres of mule.
But there's some things that are situational and some things that are, that can be, they're systemic or system, but part of the
And I get back to the point that, you know, these structures are there that keep people in these horrible conditions, even if we, you know, are a little bit blurry about where trafficking starts and that work ends, you know, still a really bad spectrum.
Last word, and sorry.
So fascinating. Here, I'm an anthropologist. I'm chair of the department at Georgetown. So I speak to people about how the law worked for them or didn't, and how their lives look like now with the T visa. And this all makes me crazy. And what Janie's doing is brilliant and really important. And I understand that there's a lot going on in terms of what are the rhetorical strategies versus the ideological battles. Versus the law that could be more expansive and benefit more people. The slavery bit drives me to utter anger because, and Kevin Bales is guilty of this, when people, I'm not talking about in Sudan, but in the U.S. and in other places, when people leave a situation of coerced labor, they leave it. They were not born into it, nor do they expect to be in it forever. So the rhetorical strategy of slavery, I think, does such a dangerous disservice, both to, I mean, everything from prosecuting and trying to prove something that I call the subjectivity of coercion, which is why is it, and some of your former clients that you put me in touch with, why is it that women doing domestic work in a high-rise in suburban Maryland along the highway do not walk out an open door? So if we start asking for, you know, proof claims, which is what lawyers have to do, to prove this very hyperbolic language, you know, we're taking the wind out of, you know, all that's been accomplished. But I'm sitting here also, and I'm thinking about how formerly trafficked people describe themselves, and it's really just, it's deeply disturbing to think about folks being talked about as slaves, because I don't see them embracing that at all and having a lot of trouble with that. I am forever riveted by how folks come to the issue fresh, because I think, and Janie, this is what I think you need to work on in the piece, is we all suffer from a lot of emotion with this, because, and I'm gonna go back to the sex. So I come out of the sex workers' rights movement, and what it is a pirouette, and it is poetic what Lou has done. But at the same time that labor has been courted, sexual labor has been more chilled out. I'm meeting tomorrow morning for breakfast with one of the national leaders in the sex worker rights movement. They are more excluded than they ever were before. I mean, so, and even from the Excluded Workers Congress. So, I, you know, there's some gains and then there's some real entrenchment. But to go back to see how you are all telling the story of what you think Janie told, and if I'm hearing it correctly, because this is why it's hard to write an editorial, because there's so many moving parts. But it's really interesting, Janie, that a lot of people are saying, so what, right? So what if there's more resources? Because I think that some of our worry is that the motives behind the fundraising, the Ashton Kutchers, the Demi Moores, the very self self-serving, but as the crowd's saying, but more money circulating. But then my final point is I would say, this is what I write about, it's not actually hitting individual lives. Right. So, yeah. So people end up, at least in the U.S. where there are victim protections, not so overseas, right? It's not like, you know, people are so boring, but this is at the level at which I write, like women in L.A. who save up money so that they don't have to ride a bus for 2 hours to go to their domestic worker job. They buy a car, but they can only afford a really crappy car, and then the tires blow, and then they have no car. Like, where is all of this money? Where is all this resource marshalling that you guys have mentioned? Where is it going? All these headlines that Kevin Bales and others are in about modern-day slavery or trafficking. That's what trouble. That's the part I cannot figure out some days, is what is actually accomplished, either by international law or by these headlines or by Microsoft and Google getting in on the act?
Microsoft.
Yeah. They're doing the facial mapping of children on Backpage.
Oh, God.
That makes me feel uncomfortable.
Thank you so much.